going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
We finally know who will be leading the Canadian men's national team, Jesse Marsh, who was named the MLS Canada men's national team head coach. Of course, he brings with him his experience with the Red Bull organization, Leipzig, Salzburg, New York, Montreal Impact, of course, former player. He was on Bob Bradley's staff back at the 2010 World Cup, and most recently with Leeds United in a relegation scrap back in the day.
In the end, I was looking for something that inspired me, right? Both from a personal perspective and from a football perspective. And getting to know Kevin in this process, getting to know a lot of the ex-players, Tosin Ricketts, Rob Friend, and then Angus Manab, and everybody really that invested in the process of getting to know me, getting to understand who I am and what I'm about, and how I think about football, how I think about people, how I think about leadership, and then the congruencies and symmetry that I think we all had together. It was a relatively easy decision that once we could see that the fit was really good, then it was just a matter of, okay, how do we make this happen? The player pool is clearly very strong. When you see the game at the highest level up close, you also know how to help the best players, right? And you know how to create an environment where you can encourage players to get even better. You can challenge them to grow even more, to commit more, to be even better leaders and have a better understanding of how to fulfill their role on the pitch. And ultimately, again, I believe that I'm the right guy for this team and that I can get a lot out of it. And that's what excites me.
Once again on the Going Deep podcast, we're lucky enough to talk all things footy and catch up with Christian Jack, who only is not just a fan, a lover of the game, someone who played it at a pretty high level in comparison to my two left-footed self in his charity tournaments a while back. But I love him because he not only breaks news, but he gives us context around those news and puts it in perspective, which I think is a bit of a lost art, but it's so important. So, KJ, I want to get to a couple different things with you, mainly the appointment for Canada Soccer and what that might signal. But before that, I want to get your perspective on a dismissal of a manager in York United deciding, for me, early in the season to go a different way. How did you view that? Different ownership, lack of results, a combination of the two?
Yeah, great to be with you, my friend. And it's been an interesting few days, no doubt about it, with hirings and firings. But that's, I suppose, is the nature of the world that we live in. And I think the situation with Martin Nash was probably one that was coming to a close at some point, knowing that Nashy was in his final year of his contract, and one that obviously it just feels like a bit of a rebirth of York United with the Pascal brothers coming in and brand new Mexican ownership. And I think every time we've seen this kind of thing happen around sports, no matter what sport it is, you get a new ownership group. Eventually, they probably want to have their own kind of people in there to help continue delivering that message. And it's not to say that Martin Nash couldn't at least convey that message, but ultimately some people often think differently than others. So I think Nash did really well with what he had. He had a very difficult situation there, when we know that with the ownership group changing last year, there was genuine concern at some point as he guided the team to the playoffs, whether, you know, they would have jobs in after 2023. So for them to start the season well, you alluded to it, two wins, a draw and a loss in the last four games, a good performance in a very difficult place to go in Calgary recently in his final game as well. So it does come at somewhat a bit of a surprise when you're looking at just like the results basis, but I think we all know, and we've been in the game long enough to know that these things are not just ever based on results, and there's a process to it. And then, like anything, people have a right to evaluate evaluate things with the evidence that they have, and they've evaluated this to move forward. And I think eventually it'll be a good thing for both sides, because Martin will be back and coaching in some form in Canada.
Yeah, I always look at these things, and it's so easy from the outside looking in, and decisions aren't just made purely off results. It's based on how things go day to day and interpersonal relationships. But I always look at, you know, the cries for a manager to be sacked or the opposite, and think, okay, well, what are the expectations? What did you actually expect to get out of this club? And furthermore, if you do move on from someone, what is the expectation that things will be appreciably better with someone else? And so this one for me, I looked at it and said, well, why now? What did you expect? Unless the only expectation was grabbing full points from every opportunity, you might as well have just done it in the offseason if it was a philosophical difference. And I preface that in saying that for manager, it's not just about meeting expectations. It's often about managing expectations. And I say that looking at the job for the national team in Canada soccer. And there were so many names floated out, speculated, so many different corners of interest on whether or not you would get a big name that maybe would appease a fan base or excite some potential donors, or the thought of, do we reward our own who've done a great job and been loyal servants, whether it's at the domestic level in Canada? And there's some potential names that could have been fits, you know, right in the CPL level, or you know, coaches who have had MLS experience, or do you need a bunch of international experience? As those names continue to be floated out, you're all over it and covering it and talking about what the expectations would be, what some of the stumbling blocks and hurdles might be. We've ultimately landed on Jesse March. What does that appointment signal to you about the future of the program?
Yeah, there's a lot of things to it, right? I think, you know, I think, first of all, you know, I have to be optimistic about it. And I think that, you know, when it initially started this process, if someone would have said to me, oh, you know, what about Jesse Marsh as the replacement for John Herdman, my initial instincts would have been that you wouldn't have been able to afford him. So ultimately, that doesn't mean that, okay, they've gone above and beyond and they've got somebody that they didn't necessarily, they couldn't get. But I just wanted to let everybody know that, like, you know, for them to go shopping into the store, they didn't have the cash. They didn't have the money to buy what they wanted to buy initially, right? So, like, it's, you know, we've seen the names, I've reported many of them, but for them to be going out there and getting, you know, Real Madrid star like Carranca, who's had performances and, you know, and played, managed well in England, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Stefan Kuntz and now Jesse Marsh, you know, to be interviewing those managers of that international caliber takes a certain amount of budget. So, you know, that the initial reaction was, how are they going to afford these people? And now we know how they're going to get into, you know, we can get into that if we want, how they've done that. But I think what it indicates is that they didn't settle, first of all, and they didn't necessarily just go shopping in an area where they felt like they could afford it. So I think that shows progression. I think it shows the ambition and the guidance under Kevin Blue that they do believe that they can go and get somebody that they deserve. And Jesse Marsh has been described as a transformational leader. The issue is not necessarily an issue, but the big thing for me though is that, you know, he's been a transformational leader as a club coach, and this is very much a different sport as an international manager. And I don't say that to disregard his credentials. I actually do the opposite. I actually am fascinated to see how he will do in the international game, because I think at his age and his experience and enthusiasm, I think could translate really well to international football.
Well, the talking point, you know, since the surprise of the announcement, and I think maybe relief that the appointment was made in advance of some big matches and fixtures coming up, was, well, to your point, you can't necessarily afford it on your own. So, you know, what does that mean that you had to essentially put it on, you know, mommy and daddy's credit card? And having MLS in his title worries that, one, is this a sustainable solution? And two, does that mean that there might be preference in MLS players when it comes to selection or development and whatnot. When you saw the naming culture of him having MLS in his title, not just the philanthropic giving of the funds to be able to get it done, what did that signal to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard already initially before it came out that there was some interest, there was certainly some rumors that they were very strong about that. And so my initial reaction was probably one of, as somebody who covers it, was initially that, oh, they're actually telling us. Because you know what it's like sometimes when you're on the inside, you hear things and it's not necessarily for public consumption. And then you've got to do a little bit more digging and figure out what's the story here. But they actually were very front-facing about it all. So I saw that as a way of them celebrating their ability to get him. I'm not quite sure about the need to put the name on the title. I think that's a little bit insignificant, and it's certainly not going to be something that people are going to refer him to. You know, this notion of MLS Canada men's national team coach, MLS Canada as an organization isn't really something that people talk about in this country very much either. And it is, I guess, a bringing a unity together of the three clubs in this country, showing some kind of united force around it and having MLS involved in bringing some finances to get him. But I think the questions that you alluded to, the conflicts of interests, are all ones that people are going to be bringing up. But I think the fact that it is front-facing and it isn't being hidden in the back of the shop and people don't know about it, I think helps, because those questions can be asked. What is it that MLS are getting out of this? You know, what are they giving the money for? I think we can find out a little bit more when we get those opportunities to ask those questions. And I think that now it's out there, that maybe the other aspect of that, they'll understand that those questions could come, and hopefully it won't be anything sinister, and there won't be any dark arts to the fact that a player from Montreal, for example, or the Whitecaps or TFC got selected over a CPL player, or more importantly, probably more likely a European-based player. I just don't think that they're going to be doing that. I don't think they're going to be hiding in plain sight when it comes to deceiving things like that. So hopefully, and maybe this is just my own positive half glass full area, and some people may call me naive, but I just hope that it's for the good of the program. It was the only way to get a manager of that substance, and as if they've been transparent from the start about it, then hopefully that transparency carries on all the way through.
Well, I might be naive in assuming that these clubs think and believe that if the national team is strong in gaining interest, the rising tide lifts all boats, and that's good for all levels of domestic football in the country. My other side of my brain is saying, okay, well, wait, what's in it for them? And specifically, you know, the way, to your point, it was described, it was not just the Vancouver Whitecaps, Toronto FC, and the Montreal Impact. It was the Saputo family, Vancouver Whitecaps, and MLSC, which are all very different things. In terms of what's in it for the clubs as they are presently constituted, and what happens if the realities within those groups change, what should we be cognizant of and aware of on that front?
Yeah, I don't know too much about that. I do know that, like, obviously Greg Kerfoot's been involved before. And I would hope that, you know, that this is going to be at least something that we can get some stability until 2026, right? So I think I don't expect too much change on that side of it. I think the other aspect that we should be a bit concerned about is what you mentioned earlier about the sustainability, is that, like, how long is this for? Jesse Marsh had signed through 2026, but is already talking up the chances of being kept around if he wants to. And I understand why, by the way, a head coach for Canada wouldn't sign beyond 2026, because when you think about the general landscape of the sport and how different it will be coming out of 2026, I would think, from somebody who, you know, if I was representing him, I would say, look at the opportunities that you're going to get coming out of this, and your face is going to be here, there, and everywhere, and you're going to have opportunities for marketing and different abilities. So why sign beyond that? You might have a different opportunity to build that into something else after that. So my point being is that I think Canada and everybody has to be aware of, like, we can't have this just all come crashing down the moment the last ball is kicked at the 2026 World Cup. You know, suddenly is Canada going to be able to go into the next search for the head coach with smaller pockets, and suddenly that kind of revenue isn't available to them anymore. And so I think there is deep concern about that long term. But as for the short term, I don't expect anything to be changing through the tenure of the current contract of Jesse Marsh.
I love that you bring up 2026, because we are in the middle of 2024. And although it's close, but in some ways it's still far, I am of the belief that every team selection, essentially every major decision, should be geared towards being our best in 2026, almost the approach of an Olympic athlete that is tapering for that big year where they can cash in. But in a competitive space, that's not always realistic, and you want to have results and have performances that are good. Now, what do you expect the approach is going to be when it comes to team selection and building the group for some real difficult tests coming up, but also understanding that there's a much higher leverage tournament in the future?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in international football, you don't get that many aspects to be able to have that kind of close competitive environment that translates to the World Cup, right? Which is back to what you said, which is why it was so important to get this hire done before Copa America. I mean, Canada's kicking off in the Copa America in Atlanta on June 20th against Argentina and Lionel Messi. Like, you know, this Copa America is going to be giving them environments much closer to the World Cup than they ever will be able to get again. So these moments right now, you have to prepare for the World Cup already. And I know that they will be thinking about right now, and they should. But I think you have to think about opportunities to understand that if we can get young players involved in these moments and environments to be ready, what will make them better in 2026 needs to be thought about now. I think when you play Copa America group like that, that is vital. You know, a Gold Cup will follow in 2025, but will not follow the same kind of competitiveness. And then before you know it, you're into 2026 with no really direct World Cup qualifiers of any substance. So this is why I think the fixture scheduling is important, right? Netherlands and France in the warm-up games, which is unprecedented for a country like this to have that. Hopefully the Mexico and the United States in September, play of games of real meaning, because that's what Marsh is going to need, because that's what you're going to be able to see from these players, is that you know, you cannot have this casual, friendly based runway and then hope to take off in 2026.
I think everyone had the education, if they didn't already know, that the quiz of getting through CONCACAF is very different than the exam of a major international tournament. What can we expect from Marsh in terms of style, patterns of play, structure, that will not only be able to navigate competition, you know, in the Caribbean, in North America, but will hopefully translate much better at a big tournament on the world stage?
Yeah, I mean, what we know about him as a coach and style is high tempo, right? High press. You know, he's got that ability to ignite a team and work very much on the front foot. He talks about the dynamic players that he's got in the talent pool. And when he talks about that, I know that he talks about players and he thinks about them like Alphonso Davies, Jonathan David, Tejon Buchanan and others, because he thinks of the pace and the level of play that he can play at such a high level. And that's going to be interesting whether that translates to without the ball. It's one thing with the ball, and I think we've seen from this team that they can be very dynamic, certainly within their own region, and cause other teams problems, like Belgium, you know, in the past, and Japan a little bit before the World Cup. But I think for me, it's how he's going to do that without the ball. You know, is he going to be really putting in that high press? Does he really want to play a high line with defenders who he would be, I think, very cautious about? Certainly are not blessed with incredible pace that he's had defenders with at the highest level. So I'm interested to find out about that. I know that managers get put in boxes sometimes, and this is the only way that they play. And we're almost at this level where fans and media are at this point where they think a manager is on the sidelines with some PlayStation controller, and they're just putting them exactly where they want to go. But I think the other thing I would talk about with style is that for me, at the international level, a lot of it comes down to the ability to motivate and communicate and inspire. And I feel like Jesse Marsh is really, really good at all of that. And I know he's going to fall in love with these players. And I think the players will fall in love with him initially. Players by design, athletes by design, are very selfish. It's a me attitude initially. What can you do for me? Are you going to pick me? Will you play me in the position I want to play in? But ultimately, he's got to get it to that we mentality where they understand that they can benefit them and the country. And I think that comes down to his extreme communication skills, and he is very good at that. He's very passionate. And I think he will connect with these young players early. So I understand that with Netherlands and France and Argentina and Chile and Peru, it's going to be very difficult when it comes to results. Hopefully he'll pick up a few, you know, draws or points and goals and on the way. But I think it's the marginal gains and making these players better on a daily basis and committed to the program that I think that we'll start to see some significant progress as we get through to September.
Yeah, a big challenge for an international manager that is different than obviously a club manager is balancing where this individual player excels week in and week out for club with how they can impact the collective group on an international level, because those things aren't necessarily the same, which brings me to the player who all Canadians seem to have an opinion on where they want to take their PlayStation controller and play him, and that's Alphonso Davies. Do you have a read or a sense of where the setup might have him, understanding that the best place for him with and without the ball might not be the same?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've been very consistent on this for seemingly years now, and I like Alphonso Davies as a left back / left wing back, a player that can really approach the opposition's half from deep, arrive, you know, terrorizing an opposition's defender from a deep position, not knowing what they're going to do, rather than being higher up in the field, receiving a ball with very touch-tight defender on the back of him, with not a lot of room, where he doesn't necessarily have a lot of time to think about certain things. Don't get me wrong, he is a very good instinctive player. I just don't think he's an elite-level instinctive player. And what I mean by that is, his athleticism that gets him a long way and terrorizes opposition. And that's not a slight on Alphonso Davies. Every player is different in every sport. He's a very, very cerebral player. But what I want to do is feel that how can you maximize the best out of him? It's been interesting to hear Jesse Marsh already talk about wanting to play him a little bit higher and get involved in the play and not necessarily out wide either. I think that might be music to Alphonso Davies' ears. I think he has definitely relished playing, and he's played everywhere, right wing, left wing, number 10, center forward. He's played all of those different positions at different moments for Canada. But if they are going to do that, the facts are that he needs to bring discipline to his game. And, you know, when he's been given that freedom in the past to play in a higher position, I think at times I've certainly seen with my eyes where that freedom, I think, has been a little bit been taken too far. And we do not get the best out of an elite level player, and the teammates do not get the best out of them either. And he's supposed to bring the best out of his teammates as being one of the best players. So it's a conundrum. I know that Alphonso Davies is very eager to be a captain for this team, and we've seen signs of him wanting to improve and mature with his media availability and his arm around players and teammates. And my hope for him is that he can bring out the best of these players on and off the pitch, depending on where Jesse Marsh picks him. But if Marsh does go with a higher position for Davies, I think it'll be a big test of his coaching ability, and I hope he gets the best out of him.
The appointment of Marsh is one thing, but in terms of leading the group, it's not done and dusted. He has to pick people around him and figure out who his technical staff will be. Rumors online that Michael Bradley could be a name in contention. What are you hearing? What are you expecting to see his staff look like, knowing that the cupboard might be a little bit bare from some of the traditional names we've seen over the years, because John Herdman took many of them with him to TFC?
Yeah, it is bare. And again, this comes down to budgets, right, as well. And will Canada Soccer fund assistant coaches who will be, you know, full time at that moment? You know, I know Michael and his family are very happy in Norway at the moment, working with Starback, getting to be an assistant coach and coaching the second 11 team there. From what I'm hearing, that hasn't necessarily been something that's been offered to Michael at the moment. I think Michael will be a brilliant assistant coach for Jesse Marsh, but I do know he's got other priorities. Jesse's got his guys, right? He's, you know, Pierre Berry, who is his fitness guy, Ewan Sharp is his video assistant. I don't know if those have been announced as of we're talking. I would not be surprised to see those names go with Jesse at this point. I'm not sure if I'm breaking news or not, but I just think at those points, I'd be very surprised if they're not with him. But as for the other ones, the assistant coaches, when it's come to Canada, even under John Herdman, a lot of them were not always seen as being that full-time assistant at that moment. So we'll have to see what Canada Soccer comes out with between now and the start of the international camp in June.
Well, that brings me my next question, and that's what's next on the to-do list for Kevin Blue? It's not as if, you know, he's got his big thing done in hiring a coach and he can just put his feet up. It did show he has an intent and ability to raise money, but what are the next things he needs to be focused on across both the men's and women's program?
Well, I think it's about keeping the players content, right? I think ultimately we know that this shadow still continues to sit over the players when it comes to getting the collective bargaining agreement settled with all the wages and the bonuses and everything like that. And that's not been resolved. I think there is a commitment from the players talking to them in Texas that they do not want that to be now directly impacting camps and certainly performances on the field when they come together, understanding it isn't easy when they're all around the world playing for their clubs to come together and unite. And they take those moments when they come together, sometimes to the detriment in the past, to talk about it. But I think he needs to figure that out now. And I think Jesse Marsh will play a part in that as well, is that we can hopefully turn the corner at some point and get some understanding here about what everybody wants on each side, communicate, educate what's there, and start to move forward to what is just an incredibly busy time, right, with the international window coming up for the men's team, and then the women's team gets to go and defend their gold medal before we obviously have, again, 2025 before we know. Oh, at the 2026 World Cup will be here.
I want to get your read on the women's team, more so in the what I believe is lack of buzz around the fact that they're going into Olympics. I felt going into the World Cup, there's almost too much expectation, and given their form going into it, unrealistic expectations, because you don't get any extra credit for winning the Olympics, and they're very different tournaments. But now I almost feel like it's the opposite going into the Olympics, where they're, you know, relatively healthy and have stars in good form, and that we should be a little bit more excited about them going into this Olympics. Maybe the conversation around the men's team has taken up all the oxygen in the room, but are you of the same mind of me, or am I missing something?
I'm a little bit the same mind of you. Yeah. There's a different element to this, right? Where, and you know this being a supreme sports guy as well, that the Olympics just takes on a different mindset, right? It's a different audience. It's a different marketing structure. People focus on different things within it. And I think you can be an enormous soccer fan in the world and not necessarily go, oh, the Olympics is coming, I can't wait to see the soccer games. You know, I think they can almost be, they might care more about the swimming or the athletics or different elements to it, just because as much as they like soccer, they are not programmed in their own mind to believe that the Olympics is that big of a deal, both on the men's and the women's side, right? So that's why when Canada won the gold medal last time, it was a big deal and they deserved all the plaudits that they get. But ultimately, when it came to a lot of the individual trophies being handed out and World 11s being assessed that year, they were a lot more leaning towards what soccer is conditioned to require, you know, European championships, World Cups, you know, Ballon d'Ors were given out for the, you know, the domestic play. And this is why I think some of the Canadian players didn't necessarily get their due. So this is still their tournament, though. They knew how to win it. They go to a group with France. They get to play the hosts, which is just a marvelous opportunity to play, play the hosts in their own country. And again, that's a big moment for this program in this country and the awareness of Canada, much like it is for Canada men's to play a Messi in the Copa America. They play a team in New Zealand, I believe, who I know that they can beat, and they play them in the first game, and they shouldn't fear them. And the Colombians are playing well, so it will not be easy. But I do think that they go there with the anticipation that they should absolutely be making it to the quarterfinals, because the tournament is smaller and theoretically is easier to win than any major tournament, such as, you know, the World Cup. So let's hope that they can build that momentum to go through. As you mentioned it, they are healthier. And it's almost like a new dawn with them, right? With Christine Sinclair moving on and others. So an opportunity for new players to step up. And once you get to a quarterfinal, I always say this, get to a quarterfinal of a major soccer tournament, your path towards a trophy or a medal, you can see it. It's different when there's a last 32 or a last 16, but if you get to that quarterfinal, you know, you're one win away from playing for a medal. So let's hope they get it.
Well, it's an outstanding summer coming up if you love soccer. Going into that Olympic tournament, you'll have great momentum because we'll all be wrapped up, whether you're in France or around the world, with Euro. And maybe, you know, if Real Madrid decides to play nice, that you could have Mbappe play in both tournaments as an exception. But you know me, forget about quarterfinals. I'm trying to figure out if this will be the first time since 66 that the England on the men's side lifts the trophy. I don't care about the Leafs in 67. It's all about the Three Lions in 66. Again, I come to you to make sense of things. I'm trying to follow the methodology of Gareth Southgate's squad, which still has to be cut down further. And in some aspects, he's giving players opportunity to find fitness. In some aspects, it's all about current form. Certainly some of his loyal servants are not part of the setup. It seems counter to the way he's set up going into tournaments in the past. Have you made sense of this group? Is there a through line or a trend that you've been able to put your finger on?
Yeah, a little bit. And I think it's a fascinating discussion where, you know, he certainly will know better than I what kind of, and this is again back to my point earlier with Jesse Marsh, where international football and club football are effectively two different sports. It's like when you receive a player, and let's just use Marcus Rashford as an example, when you receive a player who is not playing well, slash not playing at all, slash very low on confidence, you know, what kind of gains can you make within that player in that short amount of time for you to then feel confident enough to not only put him in the bench, but then to put a shirt on him and go out there and expect things for him to deliver for you at that moment? And I think what we're understanding from the international managers who have a far deeper talent pool than someone like Canada is that if you are not performing and you do not have the level of confidence, that there's just a lack of trust there. Unless you are a true elite level player, or in the aspects of someone like Luke Shaw, the position is just so barren that you need to give that player a little bit more time to figure it out because there's not 10 other players who can play in that position and might be able to deliver better for you, which is the aspect of Rashford, right? So the other thing too is that what is clear is with this, I think, bloated level of tournament play with 26 players now being allowed to go to tournaments, you have a lot of players who are going to be sitting around who aren't going to play. And I, you know, and I always go back to this with what Del Bosque said with Spain, you know, what the players do on the field, we only get to see what they can do and what they produce and what those 11 to 12, you know, maybe 15, 16 players who make a complete massive difference for you in a tournament. What are the other players doing? And what are they doing every day to make sure that you train hard, make players better, have good awareness and attitude, self-awareness, be there to bring everybody else up? And if you see a player or a character that you think is low on confidence or believes that they should have that shirt and is sulking on the bench, you're not going to win nothing. So I think there's a lot of things there that people start to pull apart and think, why is he doing this? Why is he doing that? And ultimately, as usual, when it comes to being on the outside, there's a lot of things going on that we're not sure of.
You know, someone who certainly could have sulked given the cards that life dealt them was Darren Detition. In fact, he did quite the opposite. A couple weeks ago, I had our good friend Arash Madani on, and I asked him to, for aspiring journalists or just people, give us the lesson out of Glennie McDonald's life and how he'd apply it. I'll ask you the same question about Darren Detition, your former colleague at TSN. What comes to mind when you think of the way he went about his work and the way he lived?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. It gives me goosebumps to talk about it, buddy. But you and I go way back, right? So I'm always happy to share this. And, you know, first of all, you know, Glennie Mack is a great friend of ours and love him dearly, and thinking and still continue to think of Andrew and Kate and that family. You know, and with Dutch, you know, this one was really difficult as well. And for me, the legacy was the enthusiasm, right? This was a titan of a man, a giant of a man on and off the camera, but the enthusiasm and authenticity that he took to his work was something that I will always remember. And he loved sports and he loved his job and he had a smile on his face. He read a highlight pack on air to us when we watched the games. We watched TSN Sports Center with his brilliant partners, whether it was Rod or Jen or whoever, Kate, you know, he read that highlight pack like it's the first time. And you know what? You know this, it was not his first time. You know, he knows what's coming most of the time and he knows he's seen it and his enthusiasm for it. He basically read it like he was commentating on a live piece of action. And he always had a smile on his face. He never took things too seriously, but he was just the same in the newsroom that he was sitting on that desk. And authenticity is everything, right? Don't be something you're not. It's hard. Just be yourself. And hopefully that's always enough, because it should be. So just be yourself, be authentic, be enthusiastic, and always take your love for the sport on air. And no matter what happened, no matter how difficult your day is, and he had them, and he had cancer and he went on air. If you can put that aside and just let that viewer who's come to you to be enjoyed by sports because of their tough day, and just he passed on energy, and energy is contagious, and you'll continue to do that forever, because hopefully those of us who continue to speak about his story will continue to remember him in that facet. And I appreciate, you know, getting a couple of minutes to talk about him, mate.
Well, I appreciate you, both the energy that you bring, the passion for the sport, but also the level of education and empathy you bring when you're covering the beautiful game as well. So thank you, my friend. Always enjoy these chats and enjoy the footy until we talk again.
Always a pleasure, mate. Keep up the great work, and much love to you and the family.
Thank you so much again to KJ. Always appreciate the time he makes because he is so busy. Give him a follow on IG. At Christian Jack is the handle, where you can see not just his coverage of footy, but his love of sports. He's always at baseball games or at a NASCAR speedway with his cute kids, and one of the real good people in the business. And he's doing great work, but also raising some great journalists, leading the content for the CPL. Give them a follow as well. At CPL Soccer is the handle on Twitter or on X, as they continue to grow the storytelling of the league. It's been real fun to see them go truly across the country with their coverage. Speaking of across the country, that is exactly what Canada's Ultimate Challenge has done. The reality show on CBC, The Great Competition. You can catch all the episodes on CBC Gem. You can catch the recap of those episodes right here on Going Deep after the break. Joined by Cabby, where we get you up to date on all things Canada's Ultimate Challenge. Stay with us.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
One massive Canada-wide obstacle course, 20 extraordinary Canadians, 16 mind-blowing challenges. It's season 2 of Canada's Ultimate Challenge. Every Sunday at 8 p.m., let's recap the latest episode. That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and we break down all things Canada's Ultimate Challenge with Canada's Ultimate Reporter, Gabriel Richards.
Okay.
And this is episode 4.
Yes, it is.
We got to see the new teams in action. Dan leaves Team Blue for Team Green. Adam feeling blue about being on Team Blue. The location is Hamilton. The stakes are a lot of pettiness and a lot of drama.
Yeah, and here they are on this giant warship. And the first challenge is called Search and Rescue. So they're on the HMCS Haida, and it's double the point. So the stakes have jumped up. And one half of the team is searching for these bags. and there's a caller and a seeker, and then the other half of the team is like building the boat to go around this marina. And when they bring the bags back, they have these plugs. It's a brilliant move by the producers to put holes in the canoe. So they plug the holes with these plugs, and then they paddle out in the marina, go around a buoy, and come back for the final race. My first observation is this. Harvin on Team Blue. You start the mission. You are a seeker. You're going after the bag. Why are you already going rogue, bro? This isn't Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Harvin, there's one up here. Take the ladder up.
I'm going to go down first.
Before I know it, Harvin takes off on me pretty quickly, and I'm not sure exactly where he's going. I'm a bit concerned here.
Listen to your call. Angel is out there like Rebecca Ferguson calling for Ethan Hunt, and my guy is on his own mission. Like, you're setting your team back so far. It worked out for Team Blue, actually, but I was like, Harvin, bro, follow some instructions.
He got lost and was complaining that all the doors looked the same, which is why you listen to your caller as a seeker. It was interesting because you talked about the producers. Loved the fact that last competition before the next elimination, so double the points.
Yeah.
So double the stakes. But this was, I suppose, process of elimination as all the teams made some mistakes. You had the green team with holes in their boat,
yeah,
which was a bit of a mess, which they tried to out-paddle, which didn't work. Team Blue and Team Orange collide. Green eventually sink and end up sinking their chances in this game. I, though, was so impressed in the stamina that they exhibited because, as many Canadians, fortunately or unfortunately for us, have seen, we did our own version of Canada's Ultimate Challenge.
That was
like a one-day shoot.
Oh, God.
Very lightweight.
Yeah.
These people are going against currents,
screaming
at each other the entire time. Yeah, hat tip to them.
I got to give a shout-out to Brandon on Team Red, running like Andre DeGrasse, bro. My guy was like, are you going to be in Paris? Did they clock his 40 time? They're in Hamilton. Like, training camp is soon for the Ticats. Or get this man on the practice squad of the Buffalo Bills. My dude was hauling ass. Like, that was impressive.
Did it.
So good.
Blood Warriors on three. 1, 2, 3.
Blood Warriors!
There's this initial excitement for winning this challenge. And then it sets in that being in this position of power and getting to decide who gets to go to the Elimination Showdown, you know, I'm kind of having a hard time with this. We have an alliance with Team Orange, but the person that I bonded the most with in this competition is Adam.
Brandon, again, on Team Red, reminds the audience of the alliance between Team Red and Team Orange.
Yes.
And now Adam, who was formerly on Team Red, is now on Team Blue, is watching his old team win competitions. It's like watching your ex-girlfriend move on and you're devastated. You're in the basement, you're eating chips, and she's moved on and she's winning medals at the Olympics, like on a global scale. Like, how are those barbecue lays, fam? That's how Adam's feeling.
I think it might be worse because Adam claims that he's the one who decided to click up. He's the one who brokered the alliance.
No, we saw that. We actually saw that, I think, in episode one.
Yeah, we saw that, but we don't know if it was just him. He's acting like he's Obama. He did the jobs bill. The economy was outstanding, and Trump is out here saying, like, that was me, that was me, that was me.
He came with the Affordable Care Act.
That's correct. So he's watching, according to him, his work benefit others, and he feels a type of way about it. But I also love the fact that Lekka feels a type of way about him and basically saying, like, I know who you are, bro. I know how you are. I know you're going to have a next alliance. So I'm watching you. I got my eye on you.
I'm taking out the violin. I'm playing some sad music. Shed a little tears.
I wanted to be there with you guys to the end, but that's obviously not going to happen, right? So
that might happen.
Thank you.
Okay.
I look at Lekka. She's just game-faced.
So I know, like, this morning there was, like, a lot of side conversations, and just wanted to know, like,
Can I finish my question? Sorry. Yes. Yep.
I just want to know if you guys had an alliance with anybody going into this.
Nimco did come up to me. He was like, you know, we doing this. You gonna keep me safe?
Adam also tried to deliver the best performance of the show. Like, he was reminding Team Red that he was on Team Red, and he's trying to unlock his own Adam Driver to pull on the heartstrings so that Team Blue wouldn't be in the elimination round.
That was the best performance. Maybe the worst performance was Team Green. Other than their actual athletic performance, they reveal that they say that they want Orange in the elimination challenge. Like,
Why do you have to keep it 100? Like, how does that benefit you? You know who's going to be in the elimination challenge? You, Team Green. So why do you say to the team you have to compete with, yeah, oh yeah, we think we can beat you? Sometimes less information is better than more information.
I'm going to ask the hard question. Did you call us out?
Well, the truth is, just came down to business, and we did ask for Orange to go out.
There's a lot of rational things behind it, you know, that's why.
There's a lot of rational things behind it?
Yeah.
Like what?
We all try to fight the team that we think we have the highest chance of succeeding against.
I don't know if it's fair that you guys think you have the highest chance of succeeding against us when we've been in first place.
Oh, I've been wrong.
Every time?
I've been wrong many times before.
Right,
in my life.
So that's an interesting choice of words.
My MVP of the episode is someone who was not in that elimination challenge. My MVP was Lekka.
Oh, nice.
She's the MVP because she ascribes to the no long talking creed. And she's not out here having many conversations. And both athletically and in gamesmanship, I don't know if you noticed this, her peripheral vision, outstanding. Because she is side-eyeing everybody all
the time.
She
sees everything.
She sees everything. So I see you, Lekka. You're my MVP.
So let's go to the warplane elimination showdown. Two teams go up in the air on these warplanes, 200 meters, and they have to drop the cargo near these targets. So they approach the target from about 600 meters out, and then they have to time it so that the cargo lands close to the bullseye so that the other two members of their team don't have to run as far to grab the cargo, go back to the lockbox with the combination, unlock the lock, and hit the buzzer. So it's Team Blue versus Team Green, as you just mentioned. Team Green doesn't get Team Orange because Orange is in alliance with Team Red.
Despite Adam's request and crocodile tears, he gets thrown in with Team Blue regardless.
Yes. So on Team Blue, Whitney and Angel are on the plane, and the runners are Harvin and Adam. For Team Green, Sandra and Darko are on the plane, and the runners are Dan and Nico. And Dan doesn't want to be there. He went from the podium to like the gallery, and he's got to compete with Team Green.
We are terrible.
So the first drops were premature ejaculation.
Okay, yeah.
It was just,
we're feeling it out.
It was just a bit outside. And I feel bad for Dan, because Dan had to run like 800 meters to retrieve the furthest cargo away from the lockbox.
But both teams somewhat made a mistake the first time. They were going to time it out with 5 seconds later in terms of when the drop was the second time. Except, I don't know what happened with your girl, Angel.
Oh, yeah, Angel.
She just blacked out and just dropped it for no reason.
Yeah, she had a brain freeze, and then it would just, boom.
Hey, listen, you shot it way too early. So wherever you dropped it, wait 3, 4, 5 seconds.
Bobby.
700 meters from the target.
Please.
600.
So Harvin and Adam still had to sprint, I don't know, somewhere between 600 and 700 meters to retrieve both cargo. I mean, they got to their cargo first and were able to start figuring out the combination. They had 16 potential combinations, 4 digits to unlock the lockbox.
But can we talk about Ninko for a second? Ninko's cargo was the closest.
Yeah.
Therefore, he had the shortest distance to run. What was going on with his running form? Like, he ran like he was the robot in iRobot. Like, what was going on? You didn't have to pace yourself, my guy. There wasn't a lot of elasticity in those strides.
And again, Dan, this guy is running like over 800 meters, totally gassed by the time he gets back to the box to add his 2 digits to this combination. They got to figure out they have 16 possible combinations. Team Blue is victorious. Adam and Harvin, huge celebration. It's Adam's first win with his new squad. And Team Green, again, a miserable finish, a last place finish. And that's a wrap for Team Green.
Ninko left us, though, with some great parting.
All we did was lose. I'm not feeling the greatest, but I'll take the L like a boss.
We went out blazing, though, guys.
Yeah.
We're out of here, baby. Peace.
Poor dude, man.
I will say, though, I did appreciate his energy. I did give him one of my previous MVPs. I was disappointed in Dan.
You were?
Yeah, because all this dude did, first of all he did to start was trash other teams. Then he was on a trash team, and all he did was trash his own team. Like, I don't know if I got one positive soundbite from Dan that wasn't about Dan. So I wasn't too upset to no longer have to live through that melodrama.
So Team Red, Team Orange, and Team Blue move on to the mountain region, and we say goodbye to Team Green.
Peace.
Don't miss new episodes of Canada's Ultimate Challenge every Sunday at 8. Watch free on CBC Gems.